Thank you and welcome to the Marketing the Cito podcast. Hello, it's been a few weeks. Yes, my name is Marketing the Cito and this is today's podcast. So it's been a few weeks since I last did a podcast here. Life kind of got in the way the last few weeks. Some minor health issues, nothing major, thank goodness, but just some minor stuff. And I'm over it now, so that's good. So today is going to be a continuation of my series, History and Music. We're still in August of 1966, and I'm talking about the Beatles album, Revolver, which was released in August in Britain and in the United States of 1966. And I'm doing the British version of the album, track by track list. I did the first half of the album, side one or side A, whatever you want to call it. And this time I'm going to do side two or side B, whatever. And I'm gonna do something I did last week. I'm gonna play music throughout the episode, so hopefully it works. I had a few listeners in the last episode, so that's, is that good or bad? I don't know. Not good, but it's bad. I don't know. But man, what the heck, right? You know. So let's get started. This is part two of Revolver, side two, of the album, The Beatles Revolver. Good Day Sunshine, Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney's musical influences were pop, standard, and big band swing. Classical music was also a passion of Paul's, hence Eleanor Rigby was a string quartet. Good Day Sunshine can be considered as a pop standard. Paul's dad was an amateur musician and was a band leader for a swing band. And Your Bird Can Sing by John Lennon. According to John's first wife, Cynthia, she once bought a clockwork bird inside a gilded cage as a gift. It featured a wind-up mechanism and was wrapped in gift paper. Cynthia wound the toy up and gave it to John as the bird sang. Lennon was in pure disbelief when he had opened it. Author Kenneth Womack explained that Lennon viewed the imitation cage bird as a metaphor for his marriage and a reflection of Cynthia's ability to understand him. For No One, Paul McCartney. This Baroque-inspired ballad was one of Paul's more mature pieces upon the release. British horn player Alan Civil plays a French horn, as Paul provides bass guitar, piano, and clavichord. Ringo provides a bit of percussion in the song as well. Paul McCartney. I can remember more about writing Revolver than about recording it. I was in Switzerland on my first skiing holiday. I'd done a bit of skiing and help and quite liked it, so I went back and ended up in a little bathroom in a Swiss chalet writing for No One. I remember the descending bass line trick that it's based on, and I remember the character in the song, the girl putting on her makeup. Occasionally, we'd have an idea for some new kind of instrumentation, particularly for solos. On You've Got the Hide and Love Away, John had wanted a flute. On For No One, I was interested in the French horn because it was an instrument I'd always loved from when I was a kid. It's a beautiful sound, so I went to George Martin and said, how can we get about this? And he said, well, let me get the very finest. That was one of the great things about George. He knew how to obtain the best musicians and would suggest getting them. On this occasion, he suggested Alan Civil, who, like all these great blokes, looks quite ordinary at the session, but plays like an angel. George asked me, now what do you want him to play? I said, something like this, and sang the solo to him. And he wrote it down for Alan to play. George explained to me the range of the instrument. Well, it goes from here to this top E. I said, what if we ask him to play an F? George saw the joke and joined in the conspiracy. We came to the session and Alan looked up from his bit of paper. And George, I think there's a mistake here. You've got a high F written down. Then George and I said, yeah, and smiled back at him. And he knew what we were up to and played it. These great players will do it. Even though it's officially off the end of their instrument, they can do it. And they're quite into it occasionally. It's a nice little solo. Producer George Martin on for Nolan. The track was laid down on my own clavichord. I bought it in from my home because I thought it had been a nice sound. And it was a very strange instrument to record him. And Paul played it. That we wanted a very special sound, and French horn was what he chose. Paul didn't realize how brilliantly Alan Civil was doing. We got the definitive performance, and Paul said, "Well, okay, I think you can do it better than that, can't you, Alan?" Alan nearly exploded. Of course he didn't do it better than that, and the way we'd already heard it was the way you hear it now. On a personal note, you know, after reading about the song For No One, hearing it, it's kind of, you know, it makes that song more better, actually. It's kind of weird how that happens. Dr. Robert, John Lennon, a drug song, having the same idea as the Rolling Stones on Mother's Little Helper from the Aftermath album from April 1966. Lennon once commented about the song's meaning, stating that Dr. Robert was a New York doctor who sold speed. John Lennon. Dr. Robert was another of mine, mainly about drugs and pills. It was about myself. I was the one that carried all the pills on tour and always have done. Well, in the early days, later on, the roadies did it, and we just kept them in our pockets loose in case of trouble. Paul McCartney. Dr. Robert is like a joke. There's some fellow in New York and in the States. We hear people say, "You can get everything you want off him, any pills you want." It was a big racket, but a joke too. About this fellow who cured everyone on everything with all these pills and tranquilizers, injections, for this and that. He just kept New York high. That's what Dr. Robert is all about. Just a pill doctor who sees you all right. It was a joke between ourselves, but they got in jokes and come out jokes because everyone listens and puts their own things on it, which is great. I mean, when I was young, I never knew what Gilly Austin Pfeffer Castanel Abogan was all about, but I still enjoyed singing it. I Want to Tell You, George Harrison. When writing I Want to Tell You, Harrison drew inspiration from his experimentation with the hallucinogenic drug LSD. The lyrics address what he later termed the avalanche of thoughts that are so hard to write down or say or transmit. In combination with the song's philosophical message, Harrison's stuttering guitar riff and dissonance he employs in the melody reflect the difficulties of achieving meaningful communication. Got to get into my life, Paul McCartney. The song plays homage to the Motown sound due to its colorful brass section throughout the song. It was one of the first major rock songs to feature a brass section. The lyrics were suggested as a psychedelic experience, but McCartney states it's the ode to marijuana. John Lennon. Got to get into my life was Paul again. I think that was one of his best songs too because the lyrics are good. I didn't write them. When I say that he could write lyrics if he took the effort, here's an example. It actually describes his experience taking acid. I think that's what he's talking about. I couldn't swear to it, but I think that was a result of that. Paul McCartney. It was a song about pot, actually. Tomorrow Never Knows, John Lennon. When writing this song, Lennon drew inspiration from his experiences with the hallucinogenic drug LSD and from the book The Psychedelic Experience, a manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead by Timothy Leary. Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzger, the Beatles recording. I read that wrong. I'm sorry. That was my fault. So the book was written by Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, and Ralph Metzner. So that was my fault. I read that wrong. I apologize. The Beatles recording employed musical elements foreign to pop music, including music, concrete, avant-garde composition, and electroacoustic sound manipulation. It features an Indian-inspired modal backing of tambura and sitar, drone and bass guitar, with minimal harmonic deviation from a single chord, underpinned by a constant but non-standard drum pattern. Added to this, tape loops prepared by the band were overdubbed live onto the rhythm track. Part of Lennon's vocals was fed through a Leslie speaker cabinet, normally used for a Hammond organ. And the song also features backwards guitar and Paul McCartney. The final track on Revolver, Tomorrow Never Knows, was definitely John's. Right about the time people were starting to experiment with drugs, including LSD, John had gotten hold of Timothy Leary's adaptation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is a pretty interesting book. For the first time, we got the idea that, as with ancient Egyptian practice, when you die, you lie in state for a few days, and then some of your handmaidens can prepare you for a huge voyage, rather than the British version in which you just pop your clogs. With LSD, this theme was all the more interesting. John Lennon. Leary was the one going around saying, "Take it, take it, take it," and we followed his instructions in his How to Take the Trip book. I did it, and just like he said in the book, and then I wrote Tomorrow Never Knows, which was almost the first acid song. Lay down all thought, surrender to the void, and all that shit which Leary had pinched from the Book of the Dead. I read George Martin was saying that John was in the Book of the Dead. I'd never seen it in my life. I just saw Leary's psychedelic handout. It was very nice in them days. We had acid on Revolver. Everybody was under this illusion. Everybody, even George Martin was saying Pepper was their acid album. We had acid including Paul by the time Revolver was finished. The expression Tomorrow Never Knows was another of Ringo's. I gave it a throwaway title because I was a bit self-conscious about the lyrics, so I took one of Ringo's malapurisms, which was like a hard day's night, to take the edge off the heavy philosophical lyrics. George Harrison. I've been wondering lately why it was supposed to be from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It was, I think, based more upon the book by Timothy Leary called The Psychedelic Experience. The lyrics are a sense to transcendentalism. You can hear, and I'm sure most Beatles fans have, Tomorrow Never Knows a lot and not know really what it is about. Basically, it is saying what meditation is all about. The goal of meditation is to go beyond, that is, transcend waking, sleeping, and dream. So the song starts out by saying, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. It is not dying. Then it says, lay down all thoughts, surrender to the void. It is shining. And you may see the meaning of within. It is being. From birth to death, all we ever do is think. We have one thought, we have another thought, another thought, another thought. Even when you are asleep, you are having dreams, so there is never a time from birth to death when the mind is always active with thoughts. But you can turn off your mind and go to the part which Mary Ishii described as, where was your last thought before you thought it? The whole point is that we are the song. The self is coming from a state of pure awareness, from the state of being. All the rest that comes about in the outward manifestation of the physical world, including all the fluctuations which ends up as thoughts and actions, is just clutter. The true nature of each soul is pure consciousness. So the song is really about transcending and about the quality of the transcendent. I am not too sure if John actually fully understood what he was saying. He knew he was onto something when he saw those words and turned them into a song. But to have experienced what the lyrics and the song are actually about, I don't know if he fully understood it. Indian music doesn't modulate, it just stays. You pick what key you're in, and it stays in that key. I think Tomorrow Never Knows was the first one that stayed there. the whole song was on one chord, but there's a chord that is superimposed on top that does not change. If it was in C, it changes down to B flat. That was like an overdub, but the basic sound, it all hangs on one drone. Paul McCartney. John showed up with a song after we had a couple of days off. I remember being in Brian Epstein's house in Chapel Street in Belgravia. We met up and John had a song that was all on the chord of C, which in our minds was a perfectly good idea. I was wondering how George Martin was going to take it, because it was a radical departure. We always had at least three chords and maybe a change for the middle eight. Something like this was John just strumming on C rather earnestly. Lay down your mind, and the words were all very deep and meaningful. Certainly not Thank You Girl, a bit of a change from all that. George Martin took it very well. He said, rather interesting, John. Jolly interesting. So we got in and recorded it as a fairly straightforward rock and roll band thing. We needed a solo, and I was in the tape loops at the time. I had two Burnell machines, and I could create tape loops with them. So I brought in a little plastic bag with about 20 tape loops, and we got machines from all the other studios with pencils, and the aid of glasses got all the loops to run. We might have had 12 recording machines when we normally only needed one to make a record. We were running with these loops all fed through the recording desk. John Lennon. Paul made them at home on his tape in whatever the key was, and we had six fellows with pencils holding them on six machines. Very desirable, the whole effect, I thought. George Harrison. Everybody went home and made up a spool, a loop. Okay, class, now I want you all to go home and come back in the morning with your own loop. We were touching on this Stockhausen kind of avant-garde, a clue music. So we made up our little loops and brought them into the studio. They were put through the board onto a different fader and mixed. You always get a slightly different mix, a spontaneous thing, and those seagulls are just weird noises. I don't exactly recall what was on my loop. I think it was a grandfather clock, but at a different speed. You can do it with anything. Pick a little piece and then edit it. Connect it up to itself and play it at a different speed. Ringo Starr. I had my own little set up to record them. As George says, we were drinking a lot of tea in those days, and on all my tape loops you can hear, oh, I hope I switch it on. I get so deranged from strong tea. I sit there for hours making those noises. Producer George Martin. Tomorrow Never Knows was a great innovation. John wanted a very spooky kind of track, very ethereal sound. When we constructed the original version of the tape, we started off with just tambura, drone, and Ringo's very characteristic drumming. Ringo Starr. I was proud of my drumming on Tomorrow Never Knows, but I was quite proud of my drumming all the way through, really. Producer George Martin. Paul at the time was probably more avant-garde than the other boys. We'd always think of John as being the avant-garde one, with Yoko and so on. All that time, Paul was heavily into Stockhausen and John Cage and all the avant-garde artists, while John was living a comfortable suburban life in Weybridge. Paul McCartney. I don't want to sound like Jonathan Miller going on, but I'm trying to cram everything in, all the things that I've missed. People are saying things and painting things and writing things and composing things that are great, and I must know what people are doing. I vaguely mind people knowing anything I don't know. John Lennon. Weybridge won't do it all. I'm just stopping at it, like a bus stop. Bankers and stockbrokers live there. They can add figures, and Weybridge is what they live in, and they think it's the end. They really do, I think, of it every day. me and my Hanzo and Gretel house. I'll take my time. I'll get my real house when I know what I want. You see, there's something else I'm going to do, something I must do, only I don't know what it is. That's why I go around painting and taping and drawing and writing and that, because it may be one of them. All I know is this isn't for me. George Martin, producer. It was Paul Ashley who experimented with his tape machine at home, taking the erase head off and putting on loops, saturating the tape with weird sounds. He explained to the other boys how he had done this, and Ringo and George would do the same and bring me different loops of sounds, and I would listen to them at various speeds, backwards and forwards, and select some. That was a weird track, because once we made it, we could never reproduce it. All over the EMI studios were tape machines with loops on them, and people holding the loops at the right distance with a bit of pencil. The machines were going all the time, and the loops being fed to different faders on our control panel, which we could bring up the sound anytime, as on an organ. So the mix we did then was a random thing that can never be done again. Nobody else is doing records like that at the time, not as far as when I know. John never liked his voice. I don't know why, because he had the greatest of voices. I guess it's the same problem you have when you wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and think, what an awful face. It's a self-destructive thing. He was always wanting to distort his voice, asking me to do things to it, double track it, or artificially double track it, or whatever. Oh, give me that thing again, George, give me another one. He was always wanting something different. Well, Timon never knows. He said to me he wanted his voice sound like the Dalai Lama chanting from a hilltop, and I said, it's a bit expensive going to Tibet. Can we make do with here? I knew perfectly well the ordinary echo or reverb wouldn't work, because it would just put a very distant voice on. We needed to have something a bit weird and metallic. When I thought of the Dalai Lama, I thought of Affenhorns and those people with funny things on their heads. I never been a type that I imagined what the voice would sound like coming out of one of those horns. I spoke to Jeff Emmerich, the engineer, and he had a good idea. He said, let's try putting his voice through a Leslie speaker and back again and re-recording it. A Leslie speaker is a rotating speaker, a Hammond console, and the speed at which it rotates can be varied according to the knob on the control. By putting his voice through that and then recording it again, you got a kind of intermittent vibrato effect, which is what we hear on Tomorrow Never Knows. I don't think anyone had done that before. It was quite a revolutionary track for the Revolver. Jeff Emmerich used to do things for the Beatles and be scared that the people above would find out. Engineers then weren't supposed to play about with the microphones and things like that. But he used to do really weird things that were slightly illegitimate with our support and approval. John Lennon. Often the backing I think of early on never comes off. With No One Ever Knows, I imagine in my head that in the background you would hear thousands of monks chanting. That was the monks singing. I realize now that was what it wanted. We were always asking George Martin, please give us a double tracking without having to track it, save time. And then one of the engineers who was working with us, Ken Townsend, came in the next day with the machine. We got ADT, and that was beautiful. George Martin, producer. Artificial double tracking is taking on an image of the sound and delaying it slightly, or advancing it slightly so that it forms double. If you think in you're thinking if you think in photographic terms, it's like having two negatives. When you get one negative exactly on top of the other, there's just one picture. So if you hear one sound image on top of the other exactly, then it becomes only one image. But move it slightly by a few milliseconds, and around 8 or 9 milliseconds, it gives you a boxy telephone-like quality. Below that, depending on the frequency you're signaling, it will give you a phasing effect, rather like the broadcast that used to come from Australia, a kind of in-and-out effect. If you take the image even further away to about 27 milliseconds, you got what we call artificial double tracking. Two definite voices. John Lennon. Phasing is great. Double flinging, we call it. John Lennon again. I don't mind writing or reading or watching or speaking, but sex is the only physical thing I can be bothered with anymore. Paul McCartney. People were starting to lose their pure pop mentality and mingle with artists. We knew a few actors and a few painters. We go to the galleries because we were living in London now. A kind of cross-fertilization was starting to happen. Others had got married and moved out of suburbia. I had stayed in London and got into the art scene through friends like Robert Fraser and Barry Miles and papers like the International Times. We opened in the Indica Gallery, which with John Dunbar, Peter Asher, and people like that. I heard about people like John Cage, and he just performed a piece of music called 433, which is completely silent, during which if someone in the audience coughed, he would say, "See?" Or someone would boo, and he'd say, "See?" It's not silence, it's music. I was intrigued by all that, so those things started to be part of my life. I was listening to Stockhausen. One piece was a little plink-plonks, interesting ideas. Perhaps our audience wouldn't mind a bit of change, we thought. And anyway, tough if they do. We only ever followed our own noses, most of the time anyway. From Our Never Knows was one example of developing an idea. I always contend that I had quite a big period of this before John really got into it, because he was married to Cynthia at the time. It was only later when he went out with Yoko and he got back into London and visited all the galleries. George Harrison. On Revolver sleeve, we moved away from Robert Freeman, who prepared the original artwork, not used on the album, but pictured here. Klaus Voormann. Klaus Voormann was a good artist and a really good friend of ours. I can't remember how we arrived at Klaus, but he did a good job and it became quite a classic album cover. Revolver was accepted. Well, I don't see too much difference between Revolver and Revolver. To me, they can both be like Volume 1 and Volume 2. Paul McCartney. Klaus had been a great friend since Hamburg days. He'd been one of those... Even one of the exes and the existentialists whom we got to know then. We knew he drew, and he'd been involved in graphic design. I must admit, we didn't really know what he did, but he'd been to college. We know he must be all right, and so we said, "Well, why don't you come up with something for the album cover?" He did, and we were all very pleased with it. I like the way their little things coming out of people's ears and how he collaged things on a small scale with the drawings or on a big scale. He also knew us well to capture us rather beautifully in the drawings. We were flattered. Ringo Starr. Revolver has the quality of Rubber Soul because of its follow-on. We were really starting to find ourselves in the studio. We were finding what we could do just being on the four of us and playing our instruments. The overdubbing got better, even though it was always pretty tricky because of the lack of tracks. The song got more interesting, so with that the effects got more interesting. I think the drugs were kicking in a little bit more heavily on this album. I don't think we were on anything major yet. Just the old usual. The grass and the acid. I feel to this day that though we did take certain substances, we never did it to a great extent at the session. We were really hard workers. That's another thing about the Beatles. We worked like dogs to get it right. Road manager Neil Aspinall. Quite a bit of marijuana was being smoked. I guess it made recording a bit slower, but it didn't affect the quality of the work. At this time, I was in the studio with them when they were making records, and the pattern changed over the years. At the time of Revolver, it was getting so that serious that sessions would start at about 2 or 3 in the afternoon and go on until they finished whatever the time was. At the beginning of the session, if there was a new song, whoever had written it would play the chords of George Martin on either guitar or piano, and maybe all around the piano playing it, learning the chords if there were. Halfway through a song, and they go straight in and do the harmonies or double tracking or a guitar solo, whatever. Sometimes, because it was all on four tracks, they would have to mix down onto one track to give a bit of space to do the rest of it. The critics thought Revolver was a step forward in some ways, breaking new ground. I think they all listened to critics. They pretended not to take notice, but they did. John Lennon. Like anything, people go in trends, and the trend now is to think that Revolver was a change. And the trend before was to think Rubber Soul was a change. Then the other trend was Sgt. Pepper. But the whole thing was a gradual change. We were conscious that there was some formula or something. It was moving ahead. That was for sure. That was that we were on the road. Not physically, I mean on the road in the studio, and the weather was clear. So yeah, so Klaus Voormann was the one that drew the artwork on the album cover and put in the photo collage. It's a pretty interesting cover of the Revolver album cover. And again, Klaus Voormann is also the bass guitarist at the time for the band Man for Man, so he was also a musician doing that. And before I continue, I wanted to cite my sources because I didn't do that at the beginning. That was a bit rough reading that Beatles thing because it was so small. There's times I can read it easily, and there's times like, gosh, you know, why? It is what it is. So I use for this episode, I use Wikipedia, and I use the book, The Beatles Anthology, published in 2000. And I got one more source I'm going to use right here, an article on RollingStone.com. So again, the article was published on RollingStone.com. And it was published on August 5th, 2016, which was the 50th anniversary of the album of Revolver being released. So, I'm going to read the article right here. Again, from RollingStone.com, and it's written by Rob Sheffield. Alright, here we go. 1966, the most manic of the Beatlemania years. The lads got chased around the world, playing 25-minute sets that had nothing to do with the increasingly complex music that's exploring in the studio. A long-forgotten John quote about religion, "We're more popular than Jesus now," gets dug up and creates a scandal in America. A Ku Klux Klan protest outside the Memphis show draws 8,000 people. The Butcher cover gets censored. The drugs got heavier. Paul dabbles in cocaine. John dabbles in acid. George gets serious about Indian music and religion. Ringo starts a construction company called Bricky Builders. And in their spare time, the Beatles make the greatest rock and roll album ever, Revolver, released on August 5th, 1966. An album so far ahead of its time, the world is still catching up with its 50 years later. This is where the Beatles jumped into a whole new future where they truly became the tomorrow that never knows. Crazy as it seems, that Revolver wasn't released in the US in its full 14-song glory until 1987 CD version. For 20 years, Americans knew only the butchered US LP, which cut crucial tracks like "End Your Broken Sing" and "I'm Only Sleeping." So it took time for Revolver to get recognized as a Beatles peak album, as album statement. The Mop Top Screw were gone, yet the Beatles didn't return to rubber. So, excuse me, that was rough. I had a little cough attack there. Okay, the Mop Tops were gone, yet the Beatles didn't return to rubber soul sound either. Not many had cruising guitars on Revolver. Not many had love songs either. The album's distinctive sonic flourish is that the abrasive electric rush, Taxman, Here, There, and Everywhere, Tomorrow Never Knows, yet there's also more piano than ever on their first horn section. Attempts at raga, chamber music, R&B, whatever pops into their expanding heads. Rubber Soul had come as a surprise to them, crashing it out in a few weeks for the Christmas 1965 deadline. The Beatles stumbled into a revelation of how far they could travel over the course of their full-length LP. Revolver was the first time they set out to make a masterpiece on purpose. Arrogant bastards, serenely confident that any idea they tried would turn out brilliant, and this time at least they were right. Revolver is all about the pleasure of being Beatles from the period when they still thrived on each other's company. Given the acronym that took over the band at the end, it's easy to overlook how much all four of them loved being Beatles at this point, and still saw their prime perk as hanging with the Beatles. Despite the fact that all doors of society and celebrity were open to them, the Beatles' main human contacts were each other. Four lads turned into some wavelength other people around them could sense but couldn't share. As John told biographer Hunter Davies, "We have met some new people since we've become famous, but we've never been able to stand them for more than 2 days." The whole album gives off the vibe of the studio as a clubhouse, with everyone feeding off each other's ideas. The competition is friendly at this point, but fierce. John responds to Yellow Submarine by leaving Paul a note. "Disgusting. See me." Paul's getting seriously into the London avant-garde scene, or at least he's getting higher with these guys, who are friends with his girlfriend's older brother. They run an art gallery, or maybe it's a bookstore, but they know all this cool shit he's certainly not going to miss out on. "I vaguely mind people knowing anything I don't know," is the way he puts it. And that's that. Paul gives an interview to longtime friend Maureen Cleave of the Evening Standard. I'm trying to cram everything in. All the things I miss. People are saying things and painting things and writing things and composing things that are great, and I must know what people are doing," she reports. "He's the most anxious to write electronic music himself, lacks only the machines. That might not even have been a joke." There's an enduring hubris all through the music, captured perfectly in the 8-second guitar break that cuts in at the end of "Gotta Get You Into My Life," flipping it into a whole new song. Or Disney guitar riffs, frills, and your bird can sing. You can hear that in the band's press conferences from their summer tour, as when a reporter in LA says in a recent article, "Time Magazine put down pop music." They refer to Day Tripper as being a prostitute, and Norwegian Wood as being about a lesbian. "I just want to know what your intent was when you wrote it, and what your feeling is about Time Magazine criticism of the music that is being written today." Paul replies with a straight face, "We're just trying to write songs about prostitutes and lesbians, that's all." Arrogance like that doesn't happen often, but without it, an achievement like Devolver would be unthinkable. George Martin brought their craziest ideas to life, as he put it. I changed from being a gaffer to four Herberts from Liverpool to where I am now, clinging onto the last vestige of recording power. One of the most important sonic innovations on Revolver was a sweater. The new teenage engineer, Jeff Emmerich, stuffed Ringo's wool sweater into his bass drum, getting Ringo's drum that distinctive thwomp everybody else spent years trying to copy. He was always experimenting, and the bosses at EMI didn't like it, Martin said. He got severely reprimanded. Found him putting a microphone in a pail full of water to see what the effect was. The Beatles got known, got everyone in Abbey Road thinking along the lines of improv, never saying no, responding to every idea with yes. And Paul moved into his new bachelor pad on Cavendish Avenue near Abbey Road. He now had no problem coming into the studio earlier than anyone else and pushing his ideas. Jane Asher exposed him to classical music and theater. Her brother Paul introduced him to sinisters like Indunga Bookshops, Mary Miles, and John Dunbar, absorbing the art scene. Reading Robert Crumb comics or the Evergreen Review, listening to Ornette Coleman's free jazz and Albert Eiler's spiritual unity, which Paul enjoyed playing to annoy George Martin when he came over for dinner. Still living in the attic of Jane's parents, his gold records piled under the bed, Paul began making primitive tape loops with a pair of Burnell reel-to-reel machines. He and his new friends spent stone hours recording loops they considered avant-garde sound collage. They rarely bothered to play them back the next day, but turned out into Tomorrow Never Knows, replacing the usual guitar solo with a tape solo in a crash of psychedelic thunder. It was the first song the band finished on for the Revolver sessions in April and set the bar high for everything that followed over the coming months. A more dangerous influence was Cocaine, which Paul flirted with heavily that year. Cocaine was so little known at the time, the cops who raided Keith Richards' Redlands mansion in 1967 threw his stash away because they had no idea what it was while seizing Ford's collection of hotel soaps. Paul's hookup was the posh art dealer, Robert Fraser, who got busted for heroin in that same infamous Redlands raid. Around the same time, he helped the Beatles select the faces on the Sgt. Pepper cover. He does everything he can, Dr. Robert. Paul quit Cocaine because he couldn't take the crashing comedowns. He didn't say hi, he complained years later, exasperated at the drugs' ineffectiveness. A very Paul reason to quit. Meanwhile, John was looking on enviously from his stately suburban home out in Weybridge, bored in his crumbling marriage, lounging in bed and watching TV all day, hiding his inner turmoil behind the flashy wit of I'm only sleeping, or she said, she said. His nearest neighbor was Ringo, who lived just around the corner, so he was on the one John visited most, usually dropping in unannounced and sitting in his garden while John was with the band. He'd go 2 or 3 days at a time without speaking a word. I have to see the others to see myself, he told Davies. I have to see them to establish contact with myself and come down. Sometimes I don't come down. People who weren't Beatles didn't really cut it for him. Most people don't get across to us. George wrote three of the highlights, the Quiet One's big breakthrough as a writer. Love You Too was his first full-on foray into Indian music, with sitars and tablas played by North London Asian music circle, breaking down his mystic detachment with his bitch wizard vocals. I'll make love to you if you want me to. George informs the people of Earth, Taxman tweaks British politicians by name, Mr. Wilson, Mr. Heath. George might not have a firm grasp of how taxation works. They tax your car and pay you for your street, not the other way around. But there is no arguing with the brash aggression of the music. I Want to Tell You is one of his most bizarrely underrated gems, with that jangling dissonant piano played by Paul, as with the Taxman guitar solo, to echo the noise in a shy boy's head. Paul's songs have a new classic realism, even the piano ballad For No One, lamenting a love that should never have lasted years, a very different sentiment from mine forevermore. It's the ultimate, you stay home, she goes out, breakup song. Paul sits in his empty room, replaying her voice in her head, thinking up snappy comebacks for arguments that ended months ago, while she keeps wearing less and going out more. Gotta Get You In My Life has the album's funniest line, the wonderfully snide tongue twister. If I am true, I'll never leave, and if I do, I know the way there. John never cared for Enderberg and Sing, but it's one of his best songs ever. So sketching and yet also so empathetic and friendly, packed with tiny musical triumphs. I must have heard it 30,000 or 40,000 times before I fully noticed the group hand claps that sneak into the song for the middle guitar break, and then just as mysteriously vanish. It's a hipster baiting put down like the ones Mick Jagger was perfecting on Aftermath, but after John sneers and your whole phony world will come crashing down, he also assures that he'll be around. The last thing Mick would ever say, the album gives off the vibe of the Beatles as a self-sufficient commune. Sharing secrets, all the lonely people outside will never get. The Beatles are so confident in their superhuman hipness, it doesn't even occur to them to argue the point, which is how Revolver can sound so arrogant yet so suffused with warmth. If you play Enderberg and Sing or Love You Too back to back with Ballad of a Thin Man or 19 Nervous Breakdown, Dylan and the Stones sound like sophomores trying a little too hard to impress the seniors. We do need each other a lot, John explained to Davies. When we used to meet again after an interval, we always used to be embarrassed about touching each other. We'd do an elaborate handshake just to hide the embarrassment, or we did mad dances, then we go into hugging each other, and now we do the Buddhist bit, arms around, and just saying hello, that's all. That Beatle bond was at its closest on Revolver, and would remain that way for another year or so, right up until Brian Epstein died. No other album gives such an immediate sensation of hearing them think on their feet together, hearing them communicate so fluently, madly in love with being Beatles. They talked about calling it Magic Circle, then went with the pun Revolver, but either way, the title presents a good idea of how tight the Beatles, Revolving Circle was, yet how open it remains to anyone who wants to listen, which turned out to be everyone. And that's all I have for this episode. And that's it, the Beatles on Revolver, side 2. It was a bit rough reading it, but I think I'm still kind of, you know, thinking out my... I'm just thinking about the past few weeks, and I shouldn't be doing that. You know, I didn't, you know, I just, it's not healthy, it's not good, and I gotta just go into the next podcast and go from there. You know what I mean? Just deal with it. Just forget about the past and deal with the future. And that's all I have for today again. Until next time, thank you for tuning in to the Mark Andesito podcast and Anchor podcast. The next one should be September of 1966. Finally, almost done with the year. We're getting there. Hopefully next week or so I have September up and going, so you can hear that. Anyway, again, thank you so much for tuning in, and take care. God bless.